Hi, this is WMUK's Let's Hear It, Music of the Moment in West Michigan. I'm Kara Lawrence, and tonight we'll be listening to an interview from earlier today with conductor Andrew Kohler about the next Kalamazoo Philharmonia concert called Revolutionary Fates. There are four composers represented on the program. Two who struggled with Soviet-era policies, two were self-exiled composers from Czechoslovakia and Russia. As we'll hear, the stories of these composers have great relevance today with current upheavals in Eastern Europe. Knowing that Andrew Kohler has a special connection to Ukraine, I asked for his observations on the current situation. You have a background, an ethnic background in Ukraine, personally.
Right. So. Yeah, my parents are immigrants, and Ukrainian was actually my first language growing up. Although I have to say that, most of my immediate family, the generation of my parents, all moved at once. So I don't really have very close family in Ukraine. I do have extended relatives, and I certainly have some friends whom I've met in my travels there over the years.
One of the things that I react to in looking at the daily headlines, the daily news, is whatever the politicians or the presidents of countries say has to be sort of parsed into double meanings and what they're trying to put the best face on things, and what's really happening is something completely different. What are the Ukrainian people actually experiencing now?
I mean, I truthfully am not, 100% qualified to come. I can only give you my own personal, view of the situation. But certainly the notion that that Ukrainians are, or that the new Ukrainian government, I'll put it this way, is somehow endangering the lives of its Russian citizens or even its Russian-speaking Ukrainian citizens is ludicrous on the face of it. And in fact, I read just yesterday a very, uncharacteristically for diplomats, I'll put it that way, lucid and straightforward rebuke of that claim that Russia is making, that that part of the Ukrainian population was in any way put in danger by the new government. This was actually the Moscow bureau of the American consulate, and they said, it's just pure nonsense to suggest there is zero evidence that there's been any move against Russian speaking or Russian citizens in Ukraine. So that really does leave it in a situation where Russia is simply looking to secure, I imagine, its military base. I mean, Sevastopol in the Crimea is a major naval port for the Russian Navy, and that's been sort of a shared facility, and it's their most important one on the Black Sea, warm sea port. So I think they just want to make sure that they've still got control of that. Whether that continues to go until it's until Russia attempts to incite some sort of civil war, or whether it tries to annex other parts of eastern Ukraine, where they do have more, somewhat more favor, I don't know. But I even remember it being pointed out to me, some 10, 15 years ago when I was there, that polls have consistently shown that despite there being linguistic differences, and despite there being perhaps some political differences in the country, which is something we're not unfamiliar with here either, that there's still not really any, there's no profound desire to see the country split apart, that Ukraine does want to remain a territorially sovereign and whole nation. And I really hope that militarily, politically, that situation is allowed.
Right, and it's always the so-called little people that suffer in the meantime, and this is where revolutionary fates rings a bell in current days as well as throughout history. As lovers of classical music, we see composers as well as everyone else sort of thrown to the fates of the forces sometimes tearing up countries in their time.
That's exactly right. Yeah, that's absolutely the case. And if I can just say one last thing about Ukraine that I find so linguistically fascinating, you know, of course, there's this, perhaps some of your listeners have noticed that occasionally there will be some news outlets that refer to it as the Ukraine, as opposed to Ukraine. And there's sort of a subtle differentiation between the two that, you know, Ukraina, the word that is translated into Ukraine, really means sort of around a country, so to speak, a borderland, because it has for so much of its history not been a sovereign nation. It has always been a part of something else. It's always been owned in, and some of these linguistic and ethnic divides owe to the fact that Russia, through the 19th century, owned a large, perhaps, you know, more about half of it to the east, and then this other chunk was owned by Poland. But the notion that this country was always a kind of borderland is what gives rise to the use sometimes in Ukrainian itself. There's an exact equivalent, and in English, of calling it the Ukraine, because that we would often put a definite article on a place that's a region, you know, in the south, in the north, in the Yukon territory or something like that, right? But you don't generally, of course, do that with actual sovereign countries. You wouldn't say in the Brazil or in the Germany. That sounds quite odd. I'll just leave it to say that I hope that we'll all continue being able to say in Ukraine.
Right. We'll all make the transition. I did grow up saying the Ukraine somehow.
As did we all. And in fact, my parents still say the same thing in Ukrainian, in the Ukraine. It's literal translation in Ukrainian, because that's what they were used to. That's what they had always heard. And I was the one, having traveled there more recently, that thought, no, actually it should be this in Ukrainian. But anyway, you make an excellent point, of course, because these are composers who were performing this Saturday, who were also rather storm-tossed fellows from these grand political ambitions. And we began, I think, with a work that we won't be able to hear today, but maybe if I can take a minute to describe it. It's by a Russian composer who may not be well known. Alexander Mozolov is his name. And this is a really one-of-a-kind work.
Give me a time period. I went and looked up Mozolov in our record library, and I found a lot of chamber music, strangely enough.
Oh, but interesting. Yes. Well, that's what he ended up having to spend much of his later life writing. But he lived from 1900 to 1970.
Wow, that's contemporary to me.
Yeah, it's absolutely. And in fact, he what we play is a piece from 1927, which is very modern in its sound. It's quite futuristic, in fact. And it's what it is the first excerpt of an otherwise now missing ballet called Steel. And it is so emblematic of a certain time and place. It's this early era Soviet stuff. 27, he was celebrating the 10th anniversary of the Bolshevik Revolution. And he was writing music, very modern music, very futuristic music, that he felt embodied the ideals of this new Soviet government. And that was namely, of course, the worker, right? So this excerpt from Steel is called Iron Foundry, and it is a basically 4-minute representation of the clanging and the banging and the sparks of an iron foundry. It is quite aggressively dissonant, very repetitive, and is, as the subtitle indeed claims, machine music. Mozolov makes no claim that it's anything but, you know, that's really what he's trying to imitate. That's really what he's trying to get to the spirit of, because he felt that that was really what the Soviet worker would want to hear. Now, of course, that ended up changing rather dramatically, because just a few years later, by 1929, Stalin had consolidated power. And pretty soon into the 30s, by 36, Stalin had decided that Soviet tastes were in fact his tastes. And that is to say that he had a sort of yearning for a more simplified conservative kind of musical language, something he called Soviet realism, which was really anything but. But the idea was namely that this was, you know, life in the Soviet Union was good and it was getting better. And somehow composers had to capture that in their music. And you can imagine how maddening a process that was, because it is such a vague prescription for what exactly that ought to sound like. But what was clear was that what Mazalov had written, this very futuristic, this very dissonant work, was not what Stalin envisioned. And sure enough, even though he was at its vanguard, he soon fell afoul of the Composers Union and was sent to a labor camp for a while. And then after he returned from the labor camp, never managed really to get back into the good graces of the government, and was sent to the far regions of the empire to sort of transcribe folk tunes and try and come up with a different compositional style, which he ended up sort of doing, but never meeting with any major success again. So this is really a one-of-a-kind work. This is a work that was emblematic of his youth. And the thing is, it's a work that very fervently tries to understand this new political reality and tries to make something of it, right? Tries to make a music that represents it.
I'm having an almost sense memory right now of an enormous book, Norton's Guide to Music, it was a textbook in school. It started with the Greek modes and went into Gregorian chant and Renaissance Baroque, and you turn the page and there's Mosolov's machine music making the big entrance into modernism and 20th century. And it was a significant piece where composers, as they do through the ages, take what's around them and create music out of it. And it embodies the industrial, the new age of modernism.
Absolutely. It's absolutely that
and
piece.
You're starting the concert with it.
And we start, it is an all out assault on the ears. I admit that fully, but I also think it's a fascinating and amazing piece. I said to the orchestra when we first started rehearsing it, because it is quite dissonant, it's very repetitive. In all fairness, it's not the most fun piece to play. I think it's great to listen to personally, but because some parts just keep repeating the same thing over and over because they're just part of a machine, I knew that some would maybe object. And I said, remember, if you hate this piece, it only lasts 3.5 minutes and it'll all be over then.
Well, I think it sounds fun to play. In fact, I think your percussionist would probably say, no, it's great.
Well, actually, this was the funny thing, because we did need one extra percussionist on the piece, which includes instruments like an anvil and a thunder sheet.
Nice.
And I said, you know, is there anyone who would be willing to take a percussion part if we needed it? And half the orchestra's hands shot up. They said, I'll take it. I'll do anything else. But it really is a wonderful work to listen to. And I really think it is just such an amazing snapshot of that particular time. That excitement, enthusiasm, and really kind of searching for a new sound, you know, because the excitement of this revolution could not be overstated for those who had long awaited it, and that the Soviet Union was the first place to make this jump to communism was a mark of great pride and great excitement for what the future might hold.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to WMUK 102.1 FM. My guest is Andrew Kohler, the maestro of the Kalamazoo Philharmonia, and the concert is Saturday at 8 o'clock in the Dalton Theater at the Light Fine Arts Building on the campus of Kalamazoo College. Let's look at the way the program continues here. We have Mosolov and then Martinu.
Actually, I have changed that for various reasons. I wanted to pair together the two Soviet composers and then take a break and then come with the two expatriate composers.
Then we're going to see Shostakovich, I suspect.
You're absolutely right. So we do move on to Shostakovich, where we'll be joined by an old friend of mine, Wei-Yin Chen, who's just an absolutely wonderful pianist. She'll be getting into town just a few hours from now and join us for the dress rehearsal tonight. She's Juilliard trained, and she most recently studied with Leon Fleischer, who was here just the other week, of course. Wonderful. I got the pleasure of playing that concert with the KSO, and it was a real treat to see. He's got such an amazingly precise yet grandfatherly air about him, you know? I mean, he sort of feels like every musician's grandfather immediately, you know, just upon meeting him. And I can see why Wei-Yin respects him so much and has taken so much musically, I think, from him. Anyway, she's a tremendous pianist, and this is a new work to her, but we're really excited to explore together the second piano concerto by Shostakovich.
You better let me play the second movement or I'll just leave the studio. It's the most glorious thing.
It is an incredibly beautiful movement, isn't it? Yeah. And yet not really representative of the overall feeling of the of the work as a whole. But no, I love it as much as you do. The interesting thing is that, you know, we might be expecting all doom and gloom here, but because that tends to be the sort of music that people in the West particularly think of as associated with Shostakovich. I mean, he was especially adept, I think, at painting sort of the depths of a tortured soul, which he certainly was. But as opposed to Mozolov, you know, who had this one sort of falling out with the government and never managed to really get back into the good graces, Shostakovich was a much cagier or at least luckier player of this sort of cat and mouse game. So he went through two waves of denunciation, but there was always a kind of recognition that he was really the preeminent Soviet composer, and that in a way his being, I think they also sensed a perhaps a slight personal weakness or lack of defiance on his part. So that they knew that if they condemned his music, that he would apologize, try and fix it to the way that he could, and that would set an example for all others to fall in line. So he was always able to survive these things and, of course, as we know very famously, find ways to write deeply expressive music and music that is even in some ways expressive of all that is wrong, right? Not necessarily getting better in the Soviet Union, but all that is difficult in life in the Soviet Union, while still dashing off those things that he had to appease the government. And he always played this very nuanced game, I think very well, very successfully. He lived from 1906 to 1976, almost exactly. I think that's correct. I might be off a year or two here. He had this very long life, but managed to stay sort of at the forefront of Soviet composers during almost its entire time. In 1936, and then again in 48, excuse me, he went through these two waves of denunciation. And this work comes from the 50s. So after both waves of denunciation, and even more importantly, after Stalin's death. And I think after Stalin's death, there was a sense that Shostakovich might be able to breathe just a little bit easier. We were about to enter what was called the thaw by Khrushchev when he was sort of the head of the Communist Party. Then there was a slight easing of these cultural values. And I think Shostakovich felt for the first time that he could think maybe about his future a little bit and a little bit more brightly. And I think this piece really reflects that. It is dedicated to the personification of his future, that is his son, Maxim. And even though this second movement has, I think, it sort of switches between having an almost lullaby-like feel to a little bit of a maybe paternal angst about what might happen. There's this kind of dark cloud near the end that hovers over it. The outer movements are absolutely just boyish, charming, and fun. Absolutely what you would imagine a father would want to write for his son. And I think the last movement especially is full of this. It has this great second theme that's this irregular 7-8. It's all whooping and stomping and lots of fun. And the main theme is very very sort of tongue-in-cheek, almost carnival-like. And he even works in piano exercises. There's all this transition music, you know, just because he said he wanted to make sure that Maxim would practice this stuff.
I think we have time to hear the second and the finale in the third movement.
I think that sounds perfect.
Okay. This recording with Leonard Bernstein at the piano conducting the New York Philharmonic. The Piano Concerto No. 2 of Dmitri Shostakovich. We just heard the second movement and finale. And if you've just tuned in during the music, I'm talking with Andrew Kohler, who's going to conduct the concerto on Saturday night. Google Kalamazoo Philharmonia and you'll find it.
Mm-hmm.
And the program is called Revolutionary Fates.
Yeah.
One of the features when you listen to that last movement is the use of 5 or 7/4. Is it?
It's 7/8. Yeah, 7/8.
7/8. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 1, 2.
Yeah.
Yeah, so fun.
It's great fun, that movement. And you can see even the way it begins is with this very sly wink, because you hear that the previous movement ends with these sort of haunted, repeated Cs, you know? And those repeated Cs sort of just sort of float off into the distance, if you will. They're slowing down, slowing down. And then that same repeated C sort of starts tentatively at first, perhaps, the last movement. So it comes, you know, these two repeated Cs go from sounding like, you know, the very end of something to suddenly, and then it's just all good fun from there.
It's simple, but devilishly clever.
It really is. It really is. And it's great fun to do. And we just can't wait to have Wei in here and to get to start working on this music with her tonight.
It's the kind of music that if it's almost frothy enough at the end, that if you can sort of stay together and play accurately, and it sounds like you're tossing it off like some sort of ha-ha, and it gives the audience that sense of wow. And
absolutely. We'll be working very hard to make it seem like it's not that hard.
Well, you have been working hard with the Kalamazoo Philharmonia since you took over the reins. What is it, 6 years or so?
Even more now, yeah. Seven. I think this is the 8th year now.
Eight years ago, building the ensemble. You do have a lot of kids who transition in and out of the group, but there are some core community members, and you've certainly brought the challenge with the repertoire in the last 8 years.
Yeah, I have. But I think this is such an important part of our art, and it's something that I think we've lost in some circles. And that's just a sense of adventure and a sense of, you know, just sort of climbing that mountain and going for it and trying to see what we can discover in a new work. I think that you know, even I know as a conductor, you know, in professional circumstances, the idea is very much, oh, you should only be doing things that you already know. I mean, if you've already done them once with orchestra, then you can do them once again with a better orchestra, and then you can do them a third time with a yet better orchestra. But just do the things you know. You can't possibly try and explore something new. And that seems like such a shame to me. It seems like such a shame to say that there are all these wonderful parts of our repertoire that are less explored or less well known, and that they just go unheard just because we're trying so hard to perfect, you know, 10 or 12 different pieces. For me, I think the lifeblood of music making has to be this spirit of adventure, you know, that we're discovering these things. And I think that's in many ways why I work with a youth orchestra as well, and why all of us remember our youth orchestra experience so fondly. It's because that's the time at which we discovered all this wonderful music, you know, and there's more to discover. So there's no need to stop.
Well, that leads us right to the question of, were you familiar with Martinu's Memorial to Liturgy?
I first came to know it, I think, a long time ago. I heard it when I was a high school age student still at Tanglewood. And I think James Conlon did it, and with the Boston Symphony. And I didn't really know what I was listening to. I had no sense of who Martinu was yet, but I knew that it really made an impact on me. And so somehow that title stuck in the back of my mind. And then years and years later, I thought, oh, what was that work again? And then sort of followed it up a little bit. And that's the next work that on our program. And it's really, you know, it's something that Martinu wrote very quickly. And so I think it has this incredibly visceral edge because it's reacting to a truly horrific event. And that is namely what I alluded to at the top of the program, that Martinu was a Czech composer, and he was a Czech composer who spent most of the 20s living in Paris, actually. And at first, a lot of his, you know, music in Paris in the 20s was very much about finding a new kind of objectivity after World War I. So there was, of course, a brief flirtation with jazz, and then afterwards the Stravinsky sort of launched this neoclassical movement. So there was a lot of sort of tongue-in-cheek, satirical fun, but very light and sort of not trying to, delve into those sort of weighty Germanic topics that had dominated the continent for so long.
He wrote a kitchen jazz review.
Exactly.
He also wrote madrigals for strings.
Yeah. So this was all very, relatively speaking, much lighter, fun stuff. But of course, he returned to the Czech Republic, what was then still Czechoslovakia, many times. He came from a small village there and visited his family frequently. And then eventually, once the Germans took over both France and the Czechoslovak lands, he initially tried to sympathize with the Czech government in exile, which was based in London. But then he really found that he was not in good enough physical shape to really volunteer for their army or anything like that. So they rejected him from service, and he eventually ended up moving to America. And pretty shortly after he moved to America, he learned about what kind of horrors he was missing out on in Europe, because Hitler had appointed a deputy to take control of the Czechoslovakian lands, and that was Heydrich, I think was his name, and two members of this government in exile attempted an assassination. It was rather clumsily done, but the wounds that Heydrich suffered from this car bomb attempt were enough to eventually kill him. And so, in essence, their assassination was successful. So they were trying to mount this kind of revolution. But of course, the Nazis wanted to make a real show out of chasing down these two men who had perpetrated this assassination. And even though they, really on rather scant evidence, they thought that perhaps they were hiding in this small village called Lidice. And as a demonstration of their might, more than any kind of real sense of their notion of justice, they went into the town, killed every man, many women. The remainder of the women and children were all shipped off to concentration camps, and they burned absolutely every structure, absolutely to the ground. So there was truly nothing left of this village. It was absolutely, in every sense conceivable to us as human beings, wiped off the map. And this they did with, I wouldn't say perhaps exactly pride, but a certain sensibility that this is, the Nazi Party is not one that is to be toyed with, right? That this is, an obvious show of might. And as you can imagine, that this this affected many writers and artists very deeply, but perhaps none so personally as Martinu, who was now living in the U.S., but obviously felt a profound kinship to his homeland, to a village that was probably not unlike his own. He wrote this incredible, about 10-minute work, in a kind of homage. It's titled, I think, very perceptively and movingly, "Memorial to Lidice." And I say that because what I mean is that it's not simply a reaction, an emotional reaction to the horror of what happened, which it is, but it also is an act of defiance, because the Nazis tried to, of course, obliterate this place from the face of the earth. And in a way, I think Martinu was making sure that there would always be a memory of this place somehow. And it's a really, really moving musical work.
I read that Bohuslav Martinu grew up living in a clock tower?
Yes. Yeah, I've read that as well. It's very interesting. So he claimed that he always had this, that it was so many steps that he didn't go out unless he absolutely needed to. So he felt like he always had this bird's eye view, in a way, of life and of his village, which is such a quirky little fact about him. But I think this work is definitely one in which he, so to speak, puts his hands in the soil of a certain place.
How does he score the memorial to Lidice? Are there bells? Are there?
There are not. There are not bells, but there are a couple really interesting features. Well, one is he was very fond of using the piano in the orchestra, and there is indeed a piano in the orchestra as well as a harp, which adds a certain
bell-like quality.
Exactly right. Yes, very true. But really, there's a lot of there's a fair amount of sort of subtly deployed half-step dissonance, so there's a kind of grating quality. One of the characteristic features of the work is a juxtaposition of these incredibly sort of dark chords against what sound to me like sort of beseeching, pleading woodwind choirs, small groups of woodwind choirs, playing things that sound descended from chant. I've read in some people, I don't personally hear such an exact correlation, but some people suggest that it might come from that great Czech chorale on St. Wenceslas, Sviatý Václav, I think they call it in Czech, which Suk also used and other Czech composers have used. And indeed, it was the anthem of the Czech Republic for quite a while. And then maybe the most arresting quotation is near the end. There's a rather large climax, and the horns suddenly shout out rather grimly the following musical motto that I'm sure everyone will recognize: pam 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 pim. And I've thought much about whether or not he intends to use this quotation as a sort of symbol of Germanic hegemony, you know, Beethoven sort of standing in for the kind of music that the Nazis co-opted as their own, if you will, or whether it was already its sort of inverse, that is to say, the V for victory, Allied Morse code idea. I'm not sure what the right answer is, but at any rate, the work does manage to end on a note of tentative optimism.
A note to listeners, the concert is at 8 o'clock this Saturday in the Light Fine Arts Building at Kalamazoo College in the Dalton Theater. The music starts at 8 o'clock. Tickets available at the door. And it's the Kalamazoo Philharmonia, of course, in concert with Andrew Kohler conducting. And here we are with 8 minutes left in the hour. And the major work on the program is yet to be discussed.
Oh, dear. Well... those other works really are very interesting.
They are. There was nothing I didn't want to hear.
Although Rachmaninoff no less so. So that, yes, brings us to the final work on the program, and that's the Rachmaninoff Symphonic Dances, which is the final work of Rachmaninoff's life and is in many ways a summation, I think, of his musical life. It is a really extraordinary achievement. And it does everything from take up one of those things that haunted Rachmaninoff his whole life, that is the Dies Irae, that Gregorian chant of death. He uses it a lot in the last movement, to even quoting rather unexpectedly at the end of the first movement, a theme from his first symphony, which was such an abject failure at its premiere that it sent him into a three-year-long depression where he couldn't compose anything. It's quite amazing, you know. Rachmaninoff said that he, of course, was one of those. His revolutionary fate was to recognize that he was a what they would call at the time a white Russian, that is to say, someone who had supported the Tsar, who was relatively wealthy, came from a relatively aristocratic family, and he knew he would have no place in the new Bolshevik regime. So he just left the country when he could and never returned. And he said that when he left the country, perhaps he left a part of himself there. Perhaps he had lost his will to compose, but we are also terribly lucky that that's not entirely true, because he did find the energy to compose a handful of works once he was finally made it to America. And this was the last of them, the only one composed completely in America, actually, right around 1940. Mm. And it is really an extraordinary work. Truly, I think many would argue his greatest achievement in symphonic form.
He wrote symphonies. This is as long as a symphony. Why isn't it called a symphony?
It's a great question. I think that he was probably living in a time where the symphony, what exactly the symphony meant, was being questioned more and more, even though he had written things. He always said that, you know, maybe one of the other reasons why he didn't want to compose as much was because he couldn't sort of bow down to the new forms that were going on at the time. You know, he really always idolized Tchaikovsky. He was thought of as his heir apparent, and in a way always wanted to stay with that kind of romantic idiom. And I think that symphonic dances allowed him a kind of way out of maybe that sort of symphonic tradition, the weight of that symphonic tradition. And he manages to reconcile some more energetic rhythms that are suggestive of modernism while still being opulently Rachmaninoff, the way we all love to hear him, you know, so wonderfully romantic and yearning for, frankly, a Russia that no longer existed.
Mm. It's inspired by a painting, if I recall. No. That's another piece, I suppose. So it's simply symphonic dances.
That's right. Initially, they did have titles of morning and twilight and then night, but he even took those away and just allowed them to be dances. But they're incredibly wonderful and vigorous. And I think the third movement, perhaps, might be a wonderful way to play out our listeners today. And that's the one where he grapples with the dies irae most openly.
Andrew, it's going to be exciting to see you conduct this on Saturday, and it's always a great pleasure to have you here.
Thank you so much, Kara.
Again, listeners, you can attend the concert at 8 o'clock on Saturday night. Tickets available at the door. It's at the Kalamazoo College campus in the Light Fine Arts Building. The Dalton Theater is a delightful, delicious space to hear acoustic music from the Kalamazoo Philharmonia. Full details also online. Here's the final movement of the Symphonic Dances by Rachmaninoff.